This is just not set up for somebody my height, and Pat's even taller, so let's see if we can...
Sure.
Yeah, I think you can.
That'll hide my face from you, too.
I tried it a little earlier.
Good evening. My name is Richard Estes. I'm a grateful and enthusiastic member of the Al-Anon Family Groups. I'm really, really pleased to be here tonight. It's just a gift to me to be asked anywhere to share a message of Al-Anon recovery. This is something I've come to enjoy and to love. So bear with me while I get through the nervous part. Tell you first of all, my home group is the University Steps to Freedom Al-Anon Adult Children Group in Saskatoon. We meet 4 o'clock Saturday afternoons at St. Thomas More College, room 260. Obviously, I missed that this afternoon because I was here basking in the warmth of your fellowship. My sponsor is Randy W. He came with me. He's missing the same meeting. We're playing hooky. I'm also a committed member of the New Awareness Al-Anon Adult Children Group in Saskatoon. Meets Thursday nights at 8 o'clock at Redeemer Lutheran Church at the corner of Preston and Main. I'm also a regular attendee at a number of other Al-Anon meetings in Saskatoon, both adult children and non-adult children. It's great to be here in Nipawin. I gotta tell you, Randy and I have been contributing to the Nipawin economy since we got here. First thing Randy did was go out and buy some winter clothes. I thought he had lots, but I guess I was wrong. I hit the drugstore and I hit the jewelry store next to it. I got a battery for my watch and a new watch band. Now, I tell you that mainly so that I give Diane and Jan an illusion that maybe I'll finish on time. Anyway, I really enjoyed the call-up meeting this afternoon. A couple of things really struck me there. We started with William, who I met at Marine Lake. And I have to tell you, I was impressed. William and I spent a lot of time talking at Marine Lake, and you can see just from Father's Day weekend to now how much the program is working in his life. I was kind of inspired when Abe was speaking. I mean, to see somebody who's been here 45 years and not jaded and not bored and showing the kind of passion that Abe did is just inspiring to me. And Jim, I got to tell you, as an adult child, I identify with the stuff I hear from Al-Anon speakers a lot, but the guys I really identify with are the AA speakers for some reason. I mean, they're the ones that are talking my stuff, and I really found a lot to identify with when Jim was talking. Jim, I got to tell you that idea of the puking and having the shakes and blackouts, that's not limited to drinking. I've been there. The idea of having 3 daughters and a wife at home and still not understanding them, I'm there with you, buddy. The theme this weekend, joy of sharing. I think I have a few things to say about that. So I'm not much on telling my story. My story is pretty similar to probably most of yours. I was born the son of... the intersection of 2 alcoholic families. I grew up learning the things that you learn in those kinds of families, and my life didn't go well. I met you, I worked the steps, things are going a lot better now. Thanks. I've got a little time left, so we'll fill in some details. First thing that we need to do when we get up here, we're asked to share in a general way what we were like, what happened, what we're like today. And the first thing that I need to do for you is to establish with you that I am qualified to be an Al-Anon member. Okay? In Al-Anon, we have a tradition that states that the only requirement for membership is that there be a problem of alcoholism in a relative or friend. Both of my parents were children of alcoholics, and they both grew up to be alcoholics in their own right. My mother, I'm very happy to report to you and to thank you. She's been sober in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous for 14 years. And for that, I know she is very grateful, and so am I. My father hasn't found you yet. I haven't given up hope, but that's just the way it is. So I am qualified to be an Al-Anon member because I am the son of two alcoholics. I am also qualified to be an Al-Anon member because I am the grandson of alcoholics. I'm also qualified to be an Al-Anon member because I am the nephew of alcoholics and the cousin of alcoholics. I may be the brother of alcoholics. Over the years, I've been the employee, the employer, and coworker with a great number of alcoholics. And over the years, I've had a great many friends who drank alcoholically. So I explained all of this a while back at a treatment center in Saskatoon, and some guy at the back there goes, "Oh man, you're overqualified." So I am qualified to be an Al-Anon member, but I need to tell you too that that's not why I'm an Al-Anon member. That's not the reason I come to Al-Anon. See, one of the first things that you taught me is that if I'm coming to Al-Anon because of somebody else's drinking problem, I am screwed. I don't have a hope. The three C's. I didn't cause it, I can't control it, and I can't cure it. And if the only way for me to get better is for somebody else to stop drinking, I'm screwed. So I don't come to Al-Anon because of somebody else's drinking problem. I come to Al-Anon because I have a thinking problem. Growing up the way I grew up, I have a problem between my ears. Alcoholism is a disease of perception. The way that manifests in me is that I think I know stuff. I firmly believe things that I later find out are not true. A couple of for instances. And my favorite comes to me from my uncle. It's pure hearsay, but I trust the source. My grandfather was a weekend drinker and a blackout drinker. And he would go out for a drink with the boys on Friday night on payday and come home in the wee hours of the morning. And my uncle, periodically, as a teenager, would be woke up in his bedroom at like 6 o'clock Saturday morning. "Bob, get up." And my uncle, you know, teenager, "What do you want, Dad? It's 6 o'clock in the morning. Come on, Bob, you gotta get up. Got it. Come on, get up. Dad, it's 6 o'clock Saturday morning. What do you want?" "You gotta get me downtown and help me find my car before your mother gets up." So they would go car hunting. How many car hunters do we have here? Lots. Okay. It's a time-honored sport in AA and Al-Anon. And they would go driving around downtown, and they would find wherever my grandfather had left his car. And they would go home, and my grandfather would make breakfast. And I have it on the authority of my uncle that my grandfather died firmly believing that my grandmother did not know a thing about this. Okay. Now, I happen to think that's bullshit. I think that my grandmother would get up Saturday morning, smell bacon cooking, and go, "Man, I lost the car again last night." But then she would do something very important. And that is that she would say nothing. From that, nobody ever sat me down and said, "Richard, this is the way the world works. These are the things that we want you to learn in order to get along in your family, in the world." But somewhere along the line, I picked up a couple of things. One of the things that I picked up is that if I screw up and you don't know about it, I'm okay. The other thing that I picked up is that if I screw up and you know about it, but we don't talk about it, I'm okay. And I lived my life that way. A couple of other things that I learned growing up in those families. Love is conditional. How much you love me depends entirely on how much I pleased you today. I knew how to live one day at a time long before I got here. I learned that what you want is more important than what I want. And I became a scorekeeper. I would do what you wanted to do 10 times in a row, because that was the deal. We do it your way 10 times. The 11th time is my turn. The only problem with that is that I never told you about the deal. So we'd get to time number 11, and you'd want to do it your way. You'd break in the deal. and I get mad about it. But would I talk to you about it? No, I can't do that because I'm a people pleaser. Instead, I'm going to double up. We're going to do it your way 20 times, but 21 is my turn. But I still haven't told you about the deal, and you get to 21, and you broke the damn deal again. And that's the way I lived. I did what we tend to do, we adult children. We only ever seem to end up with two kinds of people. We marry alcoholics, or we marry each other. And then we settle down to make each other sicker. So I grew up, I found myself a woman from another sick family, and we made each other sicker. We also made a couple of kids along the way, but we made each other sicker. And when that marriage ended, my then wife was caught up in her own compulsive behaviors and really wasn't in a position to look after children. So I went to her and I said to her, you know, we're splitting up. Maybe the kids should be with me. And she readily agreed. And I became a single dad. And I look pretty good. You know, there's poor noble Richard with these two adorable little girls. You know, and you loved me. The only problem with that is something I'm really not proud of, and that is that that's why I did it. I did it strictly because I knew it would look good to you. I mean, it's not the only reason, but that figured hugely in my decision as to what was going to happen in the lives of two children I loved. And that's the way I lived my life. A couple years went by and I found another sick woman, settled down with her, had another kid, and we made each other sicker. And by the time I got to this program, I need to tell you that I was a wreck. That I had no relationships left of any value. My marriage was dead. My kids were afraid of me because I was the guy who disappeared to the office for hours and hours and hours and then came home and yelled at them. My family, both of my families, just had nothing for me and I had nothing for them. And it was just a series of feuds and vendettas and long-held grudges between me and everybody everywhere in my family. I had no friends left because I'd used them all up. You know, when I got here, I couldn't have friends. I had assets. I had people I could count on to do this, to do that, to do this, to do that, until they got tired of me. And then they were used up. When I got to my first Al-Anon meeting, I had been, for about 2 years, undergoing constant tension headaches on a daily basis. I had undergone about a year of constant indigestion. I had, for the previous 6 months, been experiencing chest pains, for which I was actually hospitalized, and they turned out to be stress. Nothing wrong with my heart. But probably the most important thing that I have to tell you is how I felt. See, when I've heard it said that when a new member of Alcoholics Anonymous gets to the program, they have a tendency to work the program very hard, as if their life depends on it. And they do that because it does. For them, to drink is to die. And I can understand a little bit of that motivation. 2 years before I got to my first Al-Anon meeting, the oldest cousin on my father's side of the family, everybody's favorite, life of the party, walked into his backyard, threw a rope over a pole, and hung himself. And a year before I got to my first Al-Anon meeting, the youngest cousin on my mother's side wrote a note detailing his personal sense of failure, stuck a shotgun under his chin, and pulled the trigger. 6 months before I got to my first Al-Anon meeting, my brother, who was in the Army, was being treated by the Army as a suicide risk and not being allowed around live ammunition. And the day I walked into my first Al-Anon meeting, I was looking for the best way to check out. I was looking for how I could do that would send exactly the right message to you about how badly you had treated me. And it had to be just the right way, you know. It had to be something with some dignity and some poignancy, and it couldn't hurt. I wanted to die, but you know, God forbid I should hurt myself. And the message that I have for you is that this disease kills too. The family disease of alcoholism is also fatal. And even if someone like me doesn't carry through on that, what I was doing before I got here wasn't living. It's kind of a living death. I identify really strongly with a particular story in the AA Big Book. It's the story of Roland Hazard. Roland was the son of a very wealthy family and a horrible alcoholic. And his family decided they needed to do something with him. And they sent him over to Europe to be treated by Dr. Carl Jung, who was perhaps the greatest authority at the time on behavior modification, dealing with an alcoholic mind. And Carl Jung eventually, after some trials and tribulations and a complete relapse on Roland's part, had to say to him, "I can't help you. I mean, the only thing that may help you is a vital spiritual experience. Go and seek God." And that's what Roland ended up doing. And Roland ended up being the guy who carried the message to Ebbie Thatcher, who's the guy who carried the message to Bill Wilson. And that little exchange is part of the reason that we're all here today. In my own case, I went to a therapist in Saskatoon, a man who was well-respected in his field and highly regarded, who said to me, "Richard, I could work with you really intensively for a while, and we might see some small improvement in this stuff in your life. But all that would happen is that after a while, you'd stop coming to see me, and you'd just go back to the way you were. Why don't you try this?" And he sent me to you. I walked into that first Al-Anon meeting, and I was scared, and I was broken. And I'm glad I was, because that's what I needed to be. My first meeting was the Foundation Al-Anon Adult Children Group in Saskatoon. And what I found there was something special. See, I sat there and I cried a solid hour through that first meeting. And something special happened. Nobody looked at this 40-year-old guy who's crying his guts out on the table and judged him or criticized him or made fun of him. All they did was listen to me, let me do what I had to do. At the end of the meeting, they hugged me and they asked me to come back. Wow. The joy of sharing. That's where I first discovered the joy of sharing. Someplace that I could go and I could vomit out onto the table all that pain that was stuck inside of me. And nobody judged me. Nobody criticized me. They just hugged me and told me to come back. I needed that. I think a lot of newcomers to Al-Anon need that. I need to be very clear about that. Because I didn't have anywhere else or anybody else in my life to whom I could give that. And what I found was an awful lot of pain relief. As I kept coming back, I noticed something in those meetings. I noticed certain people, certain special people. And they were people who had a sense of peace about them, and who they were talking about things in their lives that were worse than anything I'd ever experienced, and problems I could only imagine. That made my stuff pale in comparison. And they were laughing about it. And they were having a good time and they were enjoying life. And I noticed that all of those special people had some things in common. They tended to be people who went to lots of meetings. They tended to be people who talked about having sponsors. And they tended to be people who talked about the 12 steps of the program of recovery from the point of view of having done them. They didn't talk about what they thought about the step. They didn't say things like, I really don't want to talk about this step, I want to talk about my feelings today. They talked about the steps of this program from the point of view of having done them. Now, I'm not stupid. I'm looking at these people thinking, I want what you've got. And you're telling me, if you want what we've got, do what we did. And so I began to work the 12 steps of this program with a passion. If there's anything that I bring here, you know, I'm not a funny guy when I get up here. Every once in a while I might get lucky and throw out a one-liner that you guys appreciate, but most of the time I'm not funny. What I am is passionate. I'm very passionate about this program. So I started working the steps. Step one says that we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. We heard a little earlier today, that can be a little confusing for a member of the Al-Anon family groups. I'm not the drinker. But you know, I understood that I was powerless over the alcoholics in my life. I had known that for years. You can't make a drunk do a damn thing. I understood that I was powerless over the effects of alcohol on the alcoholic. But there was something else I needed to understand at that foundation group where I started. At the beginning of every meeting, they read a particular Al-Anon pamphlet, and I'd like to share with you what they shared with me, if you don't mind. The title of the pamphlet is, Did You Grow Up with a Problem Drinker? Al-Anon is for families, relatives, and friends whose lives have been affected by someone else's drinking. If someone close to you, such as a family member, friend, co-worker, or neighbor, has or has had a drinking problem, the following questions may help you to determine if Al-Anon is for you. Do you constantly seek approval and affirmation? Do you fail to recognize your accomplishments? Do you fear criticism? Do you overextend yourself? Have you had problems with your own compulsive behavior? Do you have a need for perfection? Are you uneasy when your life is going smoothly, continually anticipating problems? Do you feel more alive in the midst of a crisis? Do you feel responsible for others as you did for the problem drinker in your life? Do you care for others easily yet find it difficult to care for yourself? Do you isolate yourself from other people? Do you respond with fear to authority figures and angry people? Do you feel that individuals and society in general are taking advantage of you? Do you have trouble with intimate relationships? Do you confuse pity with love as you did with the problem drinker? Do you attract or seek people who tend to be compulsive or abusive? Do you cling to relationships because you're afraid of being alone? Do you often mistrust your own feelings and the feelings expressed by others? Do you find it difficult to identify and express your emotions? Do you think someone's drinking may have affected you? I need to tell you, when I was 18 years old, I went to work at a place that was wall-to-wall program. Both owners were long-time members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Half the management, about a quarter of the rest of the staff were in one program or the other. It just wasn't even anonymous there. And on a regular basis, somebody there would try to 12-step me into whichever program they were in. And I had heard those questions at the age of 18. And I knew that I could answer yes to the first 19 questions. The only one that I ever had a problem with was question number 20. Do you think that someone else's drinking may have affected you? No, it didn't affect me. That's just the way I am. And I could look at the literature that talked about these are behaviors that tend to come out of growing up in an alcoholic family. And I could know that both of my parents were alcoholics. And I could see all of this in myself and still say, no, it didn't affect me. It's just the way I am. And because of that, I almost died. But that when I walked into the Foundations group and they read this to me, I was in enough pain and I was broken enough that I was willing to entertain a new idea that maybe, just maybe, the way I was had something to do with the way that I was raised. And if that was the case, it was good news. That was the best news I could get, because if it was the case, you had a program of recovery for someone like me. Because for some inexplicable reason, the same course of treatment that helps the alcoholic in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous seems to also work for the family member in Alma. And what I had to accept in the first step for the first time was that not just that I was powerless over alcoholics and alcohol on the alcoholic, but I was powerless over the effects of someone else's alcoholism on me. And once I could accept that, I had a place to start. Step two says we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Probably the single toughest step for me out of the 12. I was a lifelong agnostic. I was a bright kid. At the age of 10, I read that Gideon Bible they gave me at school and figured out this didn't make any sense to me. I couldn't find a scientific foundation for it. And so I rejected it at the age of 10 and became what I thought was an atheist. I later found out that what I'd been all my life was an agnostic. But that's what I was. I was an agnostic with a knee-jerk reaction to the G word. And here you were throwing these steps at me that had the G word in them. So I was stuck. I was desperate, I was in pain, I knew I needed these steps to live. I needed this second step, and I had to find a way to deal with it. So I did what somebody like me has a tendency to do when they're stuck. I researched. I got on the internet and searched out spirituality and agnosticism and relationship with God, and I read everything I could lay my hands on. And eventually I found an answer. And I found the answer in a very special place. I found it in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I found it in the chapter 4, We Agnostics. And I found it in an essay on that chapter that challenged me. It said, we don't care what you believe. We only care that you believe. And this higher power is to be a conception of your own choosing. You don't have to believe anything. Just for 2 weeks, it's a proposition. Behave as if you do. Talk to something for 2 weeks as if it were there and just see what happens. What have you got to lose? So I tried that. I didn't make it 2 weeks. I'd make it 2 days when something answered me in a fundamental way that I couldn't deny, and I became a convert. I'm still an agnostic standing before you today, but today I am an agnostic with a higher power. I have no idea what the full nature of that higher power is, but what I can tell you is that whatever it is, it's out there, it's watching me. It seems to love me, care about me, have influence in my life, and it sure as heck seems smarter than I am. And that leads directly into the third step. Because for someone like me at that point in his life, where my best thinking got me a nervous breakdown and 12-step meetings, and I suddenly discovered that there's this thing, whatever it is. And the third step is made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. I've just discovered that there's something there that I think can help me. No brainer. Of course I'm going to let it run things for a while. when I took the third step, about 30 seconds after I took the second. And I need to tell you, sometimes I think we should do the closing in Al-Anon before the speakers. Because we've got that line in there about the opinions expressed here are strictly those of the person who gave them. Take what you like and leave the rest. I am somebody who has a lot of opinions. And it's important that you understand what's my experience, strength, and hope, and what's my opinion. My opinion is that the third step is the core of this program. It's what it's all about to me. Turning my will and my life over to the care of a loving higher power of my understanding. To me, the first two steps are about getting me to that decision. And the fourth step onward are all about implementing that decision. But the third step is where I changed, where I became a different person than I was than what walked into the door to my first meeting. I walked into the door to my first meeting painfully dishonest, fearful, frightened, and angry. I came out of that decision still frightened, fearful, dishonest, and angry, but a different human being, one who was willing to turn his will and his life over to the care of a higher power, one who was willing one day at a time to commit to trying to live his life according to spiritual principles. And that's a different guy than you met first time. And that's all I'm trying to do today, one day at a time, to practice spiritual principles in my life. The more I do that, the better my life gets. I don't understand when people talk about getting stuck in the third step and I turn it over, I take it back, I turn it over, I take it back. Because the third step's just a decision. The question becomes then, for me, what am I going to do to affirm that decision? I'm going to do a fourth step. Actually, being an adult child, compulsive, obsessive, I'm going to do many fourth steps. Right off the hop, I did three. See, one of the problems that somebody like me has is that you can't do the perfect fourth step. And when you're a perfectionist, that's a problem. My first crack at it was Al-Anon's Blueprint for Progress book, and I just couldn't make heads or tail of it. My next was the AA Big Book again. I need to tell you that I am an Al-Anon who finds himself in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not my recommendation to you, that's just my experience. And I firmly believe that that's the fourth step that did me the most good, because it started with the resentment inventory. And what that did for me was it showed me precisely to what degree my adult life had been driven by resentment. And it brought me to an important process, and that was forgiveness. See, I'd gone through my adult life keeping score. And you owed me. And I wasn't about to forget that. And what forgiveness is about is forgetting that. And getting on with my own life and letting you live yours. That was the point in my life when the people around me started noticing the difference. When the people around me started saying, "Richard, you seem so much calmer these days. What's up with that?" And it's when life started getting good. Anyway, it wasn't perfect by the time I was done it. So I did another one. I did the life story version. That's the version that I took to my sponsor in the fifth step. And I have to tell you the fifth step was something that I wrestled with. Part of the reason that someone like me stretches out that fourth step is because if you try to do the perfect fourth step, you don't ever have to do a fifth. In the fifth, we admit it to God, to ourselves, and to another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. Well, I had no problem admitting to my higher power. I had no problem looking myself in the mirror and saying, "Richard, you're an asshole." My problem was going and telling another human being this stuff, and then letting them walk around, you know. I mean, I figured I was going to have somebody kill me. But you know, I attended a meeting of the Steps to Freedom group one day where a couple of our longtime members shared the things I needed to hear that made it okay for me to finish the fourth step and to go to my sponsor and say, I'm done. What do we do now? And after I danced around and hemmed and hawed and you know, wouldn't cooperate with telling him what I wanted to do, he just said, okay, be at my place 7:30 Friday. So, being the perfectionist that I was, I reopened and realized that I'd missed a few things, and I was writing up until 8:15 on Friday. But then I went to his place, and we spent about, I don't know, about 7 hours going through that stuff. I need to tell you that there's at least one other human being on the face of the planet who is in my life on a regular basis, who knows everything there is to know. And that's important to me. I got a new sponsor a while back, and part of the get acquainted process was I did another fourth step and I did another fifth step with him. That's important to me. If I'm going to work with somebody who's going to be helping me with my program, I need them to know everything about me. And as a matter of fact, I kind of hit a point in my life lately where I felt like it was time to look at that stuff again. We were doing a fifth step on the way here. Sixth step says we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. That's another one where I listen to other people and I don't understand. People talk about becoming entirely ready. They talk about working this step for months and months and months. And that was my experience. I was trying to do that same thing. I would go to my sponsor and what's this mean? And we're entirely ready. He says, well, we're entirely ready. A little like answering the question with the same question. I thought he was getting all zen on me or something and was just confused. But then I ended up back where I seemed to find my answers. And you know, in the AA Big Book, it tells me precisely how to do the sixth step. It says, upon conclusion of our fifth step, we went home, we took this book down from the shelf, and we reviewed those first five proposals. And what the sixth step means to me these days is that if I have truly admitted my own powerlessness, if I have truly come to believe in a loving higher power, and if I have, with full commitment, turned my will and my life over to the care of that same loving higher power, if I have examined my moral character to the best of my ability, and if I have shared that openly and fully with another human being, then I am entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Nowhere in the step does it say became ready. It says were. It's a check stop for me. Seventh step says, humbly ask God to remove our shortcomings. Ten minutes and a prayer. To me. And it's interesting. The joy of sharing. I'm going to come back to that for a second because somewhere around the time I took the third step, the joy of sharing took a very different meaning for me. The joy of sharing in that time in my life was going to meetings and talking about this program and these steps and holding those ideas out where I could see them and having those connected dot moments and learning as I was speaking. And you know, that's still going on today. A few months ago I was speaking and something clicked in front of 150 people. I don't think they noticed, but something clicked for me to change my view on this step. And here's where I'm at today. Seventh step for me is two parts. It's 10 minutes and the rest of my life. I say the prayer I ask the loving higher power of my understanding to remove from me all those defects of character that stand in the way of my usefulness to him and my fellows. The other phase is the rest of my life, because nowhere in that step does it say that he's going to remove my defects of character today. And my experience has been that he doesn't even take them all. And I think that comes back to that line of the ones that stand in my way, in the way of my usefulness. Every once in a while, I think it's useful for him, for me to have a defect of character. I'm a good, bad example of something. On the other hand, it's been my experience that the ones that get in the way get removed. And this is the way it happens. I'm presented with an opportunity to practice the defect of character. So I do. But I'm aware of it. I notice it this time. And I'm presented with another opportunity to practice the defect of character. And I notice it more. And I do it again. And I feel bad about it. And I'm presented another opportunity. And maybe this time, I choose something different. And I'm on my way to building a new habit. Again and again and again in my life, those are the way the tough ones get dealt with. A number of my defects of character seem to vanish right around the time I took the third step, right around the time I took the seventh step. But you know, the ones that have really interfered in my life, they go gradually. This is, for me, it's the progress, not perfection step. The best example I can think of on an ongoing basis in my life is one of my defects of character is the need to be right. You know, off that list that I read you, we fear criticism. Okay, we fear criticism because that we might be wrong. If we're wrong, that's just unsafe. Well, for someone like me, the worst place to put him is someplace where the rules are on his side. And for me, that's the left-hand lane on the freeway doing 90 kilometers an hour in a 90 kilometer zone. Because there's invariably somebody coming up behind me who thinks that that 90 on the sign at the side of the road is a minimum speed instead of a maximum speed. And he's really upset that I'm in his way. But the rules are on my side. So I really, at a certain level, I enjoy sitting there doing exactly 90 kilometers an hour. And looking at him in the rearview mirror and seeing his face get all red and watching him wave at me with one finger. There's a sense of power there because the rules are on my side. Spiritual growth says, Richard, play nice. Do you need to be here? Do you need to be causing him this kind of upset? As soon as it's safe, shoulder check, signal, change lanes, get out of his way. And I do. You know, and somehow I seem to heal a little bit every time I do. Eighth step. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. And the ninth step, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. I can tell you that a lot of my amends have been through the process rather than waiting until I got to that step. And I think some of that came because my biggest amends were that I needed to make were to my wife, to my kids, to the people I worked with on a daily basis. And in the midst of my fourth step and realizing exactly what I had done with and to those people, I couldn't face the idea of saying to them, you know, I realize I screwed you over, but I can't really do anything about it yet because I've not done my paperwork. You know, it just didn't make any sense to me. And so I have tended to be very opportunistic about doing amends. I can also tell you that the amends that go well are the ones that I talk about with my sponsor. The ones that don't go well are the ones that I just go off and do by myself. So I would recommend the whole sponsor approach myself. 10th step says continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. I love that when. when we were wrong. Now that's the word in that step that gives me permission to be human. It's a recognition up front that I'm going to screw up. And I do on a regular basis. And then it gives me a mechanism for dealing with it. When we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Go and make amends. One more time, I'm sorry I said what I said the way that I said it. But you know what? Being in that habit means that I have much better relationships in my life than I used to have. The 11th step. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. After the third, this is probably my favorite step. It's the one that I work on the most these days. You know, I'm an agnostic with favorite prayers. How ironic is that? One of those I want to share with you, because it speaks directly to the nature of my disease. Remember my disease? I think I know stuff. I don't know if you're familiar with the set-aside prayer, but it goes something like this. Father, help me to set aside everything I think I know about You. Help me to set aside everything I think I know about myself. Help me to set aside everything I think I know about others. And help me to set aside everything I think I know about this program, so that I may have a new experience in You, a new experience in myself, a new experience in my fellows, and a new experience in my own recovery. Thanks for listening. That's, by the way, that's how I end my prayers. I figure, I don't know if he's listening or not, but if he is, I should thank him. And if he's not, it doesn't hurt. Doesn't that prayer speak directly to the nature of the disease of someone like me? You know, help me to set aside all this stuff that I think I know. And that's why I love it so much. The 11th step is one that I try to share on a daily basis with the woman with whom I share my life. We said before, when I got to this program, my marriage was dead. My wife had made an offer on another house in order to try to get away from me. And then she had a second thought and decided to give us one more chance. And I was in program for a while, and she noticed some changes. And she got interested in whatever the heck this was that was changing Richard. Maybe it was something that held something for her, and she got into recovery. And today, on a daily basis, we share this step. We make a point of every morning doing our daily readings together, praying together, and it's incredible. It's just a huge part of both our programs. And even when one of us is out of town, this morning I woke up in Melfort and I phoned her in Saskatoon, and we had morning coffee and did our morning readings and prayers. And it's a huge part of our life. Today, I live a very different life than I did when I got here. Not many of my circumstances have changed, but my life is different. Still married to the same woman, but something has changed here. You know, if there's a message that I have for you, it's that these steps work. They work whether or not you believe that they're going to work. If you do these steps, that you change. I don't understand the mechanism. All I can tell you is what I've experienced and what I've observed in the rooms. My motive when I first started working those steps so hard was that I wanted to get better, I wanted to get healthier, I wanted to get stronger so that I could take a long, hard look at my marriage. And I could be the one who decided whether it should continue or not. At least that's what I told myself. What I know now through several inventories, what I really had in mind was I wanted to get stronger, I wanted to get healthier, so I could be the one to end it so she could know what it felt like to be treated that way. That was my plan. the steps, spoil that plan. I got to tell you, I lost interest in that plan. And I fell in love with my wife all over again. Now, life isn't perfect these days. Recovery doesn't help me to have a perfect life. It helps me to better deal with an imperfect life. I had a really strong example came a little while ago. My oldest daughter is someone who has kind of lived life according to the beat of a different drummer, and she's had a very difficult life, and it came to light a couple of years before I got the program that when she was very small, she had been molested by one of the alcoholics in my life. And it affected her deeply, and it affected her all her life. And when I found out about it a couple of years before I got the program, I didn't know what to do with it. And I hurt and I raged and I wanted to kill the guy and all of the predictable reactions. What I couldn't do is I couldn't be there for her. Because it just hurt too much to be near her. We got in a program. You know what? She also became motivated watching me and watching her stepmother. She became motivated to get some help for herself. And as part of that, a few months ago, she asked us to come and talk to her. And she shared with us that in high school, twice, she was raped. Now, and I had those feelings, like, when will this kid catch a break? But you know what? It did something differently. My wife and I, we went home, we cried. We phoned our sponsors. We practiced our programs, and as a result of that, we were able to be there not only for each other, but for her. And how far is that from where we were? I cry when I get up here, sorry. In the 12th step, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to others and to practice these principles in all our affairs. That's what I'm trying to do up here tonight. To tell you that as the result of working these steps, I am changed. I was selfish, self-centered, and fearful when I got here. And I am still selfish, self-centered, and fearful, but I am committed to trying to work, do my life differently thanks to the things that you've taught me. And as a result of the things that I've gained here, I feel a sense of commitment and a sense of purpose and an obligation to pay back. And you know what? We can't pay back here. The people who got me this far, I have no way of repaying. What the program tells us is to pay it forward, to carry a message of hope to the struggling newcomer. To me, that says, go talk to new people. It says, sponsor guys. And what a gift that is. I got a guy, a sponsor. I absolutely adore him. Because on a regular basis, he phones me to tell me precisely how his marriage is going. I seem to attract guys who are having marital problems for some reason. I don't know why that is. And he phones me to tell me what's happening, to make things go sideways today. And somehow or other, every time I get off the phone with him, I am so in love with my wife. And it's to the point where I get off the phone and she sees a look in my eye and she says, Scott phone, didn't he? Yeah, what can I say? You know, the other thing that you don't hear a lot of from up here is the traditions. I need to tell you that mine is a disease of relationships. And to me, the traditions are all about healthy relationships. How to do things better between us. And I happen to be married to a lady who thinks the same way. This summer, we renewed our wedding vows, and it became a real program event between our home groups. Randy was the minister. He performed the ceremony for us. My first sponsor was the father of the bride, and my wife's sponsor was the mother of the bride, and they walked her down the aisle and handed her off to me, and we exchanged vows that were based on the 12 traditions of this program. And the people in the congregation were not our family. They were you, the people who had saved our marriage. It was a joyous experience. And then, a little over a month ago, she and I had the privilege of doing a workshop based on those vows that we'd written on how to apply the 12 traditions of this program to our love relationships. I have no way to tell you how powerful that was for me. You know, at Marine Lake Roundup, I had the privilege of listening to Lois and Butch share together. They get up, instead of each of them getting up for an hour, they get up for 2 hours together and they tag team. And it's a real mind-blowing experience. And I'm looking at that thinking, I could never do that. But you know what, Karen and I did this. And we couldn't have done that before. That was so cool. My kids, I have relationships with my kids today. Yeah. A lot of you at the Marine Lake Roundup met two of my daughters, and I need to tell you that since then, we had a great weekend, but since then, on an ongoing basis, I've been the world's best dad, I've been the world's worst dad. Best dad, worst dad, best dad, worst dad. But it's different now. Even when they're as angry as they can possibly be with me, which is pretty angry when you think about a 15-year-old and an 18-year-old, and the world revolves around them. But even at its worst, it's better than it ever was. Now, this is the stuff that you've given me. I'd like if you indulge me, I'd like to share those vows with you because I kind of feel like I owe them to you. It's going to sound awfully familiar. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal growth within our marriage depends upon unity. Two, for the purpose of our marriage, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving higher power as expressed through our mutual conscience. Each of us is a trusted servant, and neither of us governs. Three, the only requirement for membership in our marriage is a commitment to the marriage and a willingness to make it work. Four, each of us is autonomous, except in matters affecting our partner or our family or the wider community as a whole. Five, our marriage has but one purpose, to serve as an expression of our higher power's love. We do this by practicing the 12 steps ourselves, by encouraging and nurturing each other's growth, and by welcoming and loving our friends and families. Six, neither of us should ever endorse, finance, or otherwise commit our family to any outside enterprise without prior consultation, lest problems of money, pride, or ego divert us from our primary spiritual aim. Seven, our marriage ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Each of us strives to be self-supporting, physically, emotionally, and spiritually. Eight, our love should remain forever unconditional, but we have the right to ask for what we need. Nine, our marriage as such ought never be organized, but we may temporarily appoint one or the other to special tasks as they suit our interests or talents. I need to tell you, I've been temporarily the computer guy for about 14 years. Ten, outside issues have no place between us. We as individuals are free to follow our personal truth, but we must never commit our partner or our marriage to outside controversy. 11, our personal opinions should be communicated openly, honestly, and directly, with respect and courtesy. We need always maintain personal humility in all our affairs. And 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of our marriage, ever reminding us to place principles above personalities. There's another message that I have for you. It's that those traditions, if your disease is anything like mine, are as important as the steps. Because it is a disease of relationships. And while I can work the steps and I can get better, it doesn't do any good if we don't get better. The joy of sharing in that 12th step again has taken on a new meaning for me. There's something so cool about getting up someplace like this, or sharing in a meeting, or sitting down for coffee with some new person and hearing something come out of my mouth that I didn't know. And having that feeling of being the messenger, the instrument rather than the player. And having a sense of purpose and commitment in my life. Part of the joy of sharing becomes when I become committed to the fifth tradition, the importance of carrying a message of hope to the newcomer. I have a new favorite reading. Look it up. It's in Al-Anon One Day at a Time book, November 24th. Talks about the importance of remembering the newcomer when I'm sharing at a meeting. Will what I have to say help that person? And that really moves me away from where I was when I showed up at my first meeting and first discovered the joy of sharing, because what I try not to do now is that self-centered sharing that I needed to do as a newcomer. You know, then it was, I need the pain relief. Now it's, what can I do to help? What can I do to carry a message? And that brings me to my other favorite prayer. And it's my when all else fails prayer. Life has fallen apart. It's a real emergency this time. It goes something like this. HP, I'm hurting, and I'm angry, and I'm confused, and I'm frightened. And I'm really starting to feel sorry for myself. Please send me someone to help. You know, the amazing thing is I've never had that prayer not answered. And it gets answered with a promptness that I can't even begin to explain. When I sit at home and I pray this prayer, and within 5 minutes, somebody's on the phone saying, can I talk to you about how to work this step? Or somebody's on the phone saying, do you know what she did now? You know what? My problems don't look so bad. And we get Richard out of Richard. Heard a reference today to the third step prayer, another of my favorites. You know, the bondage of self. That's what this is all about for me, is finally, for the first time in my life, being released of the bondage of Richard. Come back again to that third step, because to me, that is what this program means. Everything else is just a way of making it happen. In the AA Big Book, when it talks about the third step and turning our will and our lives over the care of God as we understood Him, it says that when we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. I need to tell you that that has been my experience. When I sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. I owe you for my life, my marriage, my kids, my job. I owe you everything. Thank you. Thank you so much for letting me share.